Thanks, Hans, and good morning, everyone. I would like to highlight a couple of points before we discuss the specific issues in agenda papers 18A and 18B. First, as explained in paragraph 2 of the cover paper, this discussion is a continuation of the discussion you had in December 2017. Consequently, when discussing agenda papers 18A and 18B, we request that the board members bear in mind the collective consideration of all the project approaches that we discussed in December 2017 and not the two issues as standalone issues. And second, we prepared the papers assuming that the next stage of the research project would be a discussion paper. However, we will ask you for a formal decision on the next stage of the project at a future meeting. Now, proceeding to agenda paper 18A, we ask you for your choice of the course of action in response to the feedback from the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 about the requirement in IAS 36 to use pre-tax inputs in calculating value in use. Now, the background and introduction section of the paper sets out the requirements in IAS 36 and the feedback the board received during both PIR of IFRS 3 and also back in 2004 when IAS 36 was revised. We draw your attention to paragraph 6 of the paper, in which we highlight what taxes are being referred to when we say pre-tax or post-tax in the context of value in use. On the basis of the analysis of the issue, we set out three possible approaches in paragraph 27 of the paper for your consideration. Now, the first approach, which is to retain the requirement to use pre-tax inputs, we do not recommend that the board consider that approach for the reasons set out in the paper. Now, the second approach would be to remove the explicit requirement in IAS 36 to use pre-tax inputs and instead require an entity to use consistent inputs, which means pre-tax cash flows to be discounted using a pre-tax discount rate or post-tax cash flows to be discounted using a post-tax discount rate, and also to disclose the discount rate actually used as the input. Now, we recommend that approach because, as explained in December 2017, this will moderately contribute to simplifying calculating value in use and, more importantly, improve the quality of information provided to the users of financial statements. Now, the third approach would be to resolve the double counting issue, and we do not recommend this approach for the reasons explained in paragraph 42 of the paper. With that, I turn the discussion to you and ask you for your preferred course of action.
First thing is, I want to say thanks and applause prospectively to the next paper also for the, you know, taking the time to do, I think, a good, thoughtful analysis of the literature and the implications. Helpful to feel we've really bottomed out the issue. Having gone through this, I do remain concerned at a conceptual level that we're kind of creating and something like a day one, day two measurement basis difference. And what I mean is, let's assume a perfect world that doesn't exist and everything happens exactly as forecasted in the value in use calculation. If that happens, and let's say, Mark, then the result will be that the entity has a loss in each period because the tax liabilities will be a greater amount. It's the difference between the discounted basis and the undiscounted basis. So that's what I mean by conceptually there's a day one, day two difference, because the tax cash flows are discounted in the impairment calculation when they're not discounted when you actually come to them and there's no accretion. Now, having said that, from a conceptual perspective, it may be that this is worrying about this level of precision in an analysis that has this level of uncertainty attached to it. Yeah. So maybe this isn't the thing to focus on, but I did want to point out that conceptually I think we do create kind of this day one, day two measurement difference but that's likely to get lost in the noise.
Nick?
Thank you. I would support staff's recommendation that we have a consistent approach here. I think both users and preparers find post-tax rates more intuitive use, but we should allow preparers to choose which is the best route to go down. I wonder whether the double counting is overstated, in that I think the paper very clearly shows that today, in terms of people using a pre-tax approach, they tend to use a post-tax calculation and work back to that. So if there is a double counting issue, we already have it today. And the second consideration, particularly in respect of goodwill, is that in most jurisdictions, goodwill isn't tax deductible. So I'm not sure that there is that tax issue there, but specifically in respect of goodwill anyway.
Goodwill isn't?
Isn't tax deductible in most jurisdictions.
In most jurisdictions,
it's not tax deductible.
And so I asked Raghava to explain this paper to me, and my first question was, what is a pre-tax discount rate? And the answer was, nobody knows. So everybody starts from a post-tax discount rate, then works his way back to achieve a pre-tax discount rate. So it's reverse engineering and the same amount results. So I think it's a fantastic example of fake accuracy. That is being achieved here conceptually pure, but in a level four estimate. So I think if we can simplify this only a little bit, we should do so and not try to resolve a very small double counting issue. It was well worth to get the explanation, Raghava.
The paper was really helpful. I found it really helpful for me. So thank you.
Okay, so we seem to agree. Finally, a major victory. In
just for the record, I'm assuming you're agreeing with approach two rather than approach three.
Yes. Staff recommendation.
Okay, 18B.
Yes. Agenda paper 18B, we ask the board whether it wishes to consider removing the restriction to exclude cash flow arising from future restructuring or future performance enhancement from the calculation of value in use. So I'd like to draw your attention to paragraph 10 in this paper. That explains why IAS 36 arguably imposes a restriction on cash flow projections about potential future restructuring or future enhancement. On the basis of the analysis in paragraph 11 to 19, we concluded that this restriction is not consistent with the concept of value in use. So we think removing this restriction would not lead to significant change in the concept of value in use and would rather eliminate the unnecessary cost, as explained in paragraph 21 of this paper. However, we also think estimated cash flows or discount rates relating to a potential restructuring or enhancement should reflect the range of possible outcomes rather than a single, most likely minimum or maximum possible amount. I think this concept is consistent with general principles of present value techniques set out paragraph A3 of IS 36. So consequently, as already highlighted in agenda paper 18D for the December 2017 meeting, we think this approach would moderately contribute to achieving the simplification objective. So we are asking you whether you wish to consider removing this restriction.
I agree with the idea of removing the restriction because it seems a little bit artificial, and I can see that it would improve the consistency between the different measurements, but I'm a little bit hesitant about whether it's really going to be a simplification in the standard setting sense, because I think, as you rightly point out in the paper, if somebody's looking at something like a fair value, they're looking at the potential for restructuring, but if they're doing it properly, I think they're thinking about the likelihood of that occurring or not occurring. And I can't imagine us allowing people just to, you know, I think we'd need criteria for when it would be appropriate to include restructuring. So in this, you know, is it enough that it's in budget, so therefore you can just take that one scenario? Do you need to think about the likelihood of the outcomes? How do you deal with the possibility that it may or may not be successful? And because fair value sort of sweeps those concepts in sort of indirectly. And so I think it's fine to think about removing it, but are we going to do some work on how you go about including it and when it's appropriate to include it? So I don't know what your thinking is in terms of whether we would need to do that, whether we'd just flag that in the document we put out for comment, whether we develop that for comment, or what your reaction is.
I think given that, as we said, we prepared these papers assuming that the next stage would be a discussion paper. I mean, what we had at the back of our mind is to set out all these concerns. And then, because on this topic of removing the restriction on the restrictions, the feedback was mainly from preparers. But if we have this complete discussion, as you highlighted in the discussion paper, it's possible that we could get the counter arguments from the other constituents and accordingly.
But yeah, and also I think we need to be careful not to make it sound like it's going to be an easier thing than it might be.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you can just pick up your budget and that's what you include in your scenarios, that we may expect you to think a bit harder about. I don't know if we want to go all the way to expected value type concepts, but I think we need some parameters around the appropriateness of including a really super optimistic budget target that's got, you know, huge risk of achievability, but, you know, management wants you to aim high, and what we do in those scenarios. And I hate people to say, yeah, we love this idea, and then we say, ta-da, this is now what it looks like, and they're like, well, we don't like it anymore.
Jin-cha.
Thank you, guys. A similar to comment also, I have some observation with these changes, because I have several questions. One is that on the existing standards, actually uncommitted restructuring was excluded from when we calculated the value in use. So when we introduce a new notion of the potential for restructuring or enhancement, so it seemed that those uncommitted committed restriction cash flows will be included.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's
if really broad. Exist, yeah.
The cash future cash flow, because management can easier to manage their numbers because those future cash flow not committed. So it's a big change to current practice. Secondly, the existing standards are not allowed to include future cash flow for those enhancements. I think enhancements is different, because once they're doing enhancement, first they should have added some cost or expenditure for those assets. So the actually the carry amount of the assets have been changed, not simply the future cash flow can change it, because we compare the value in use and the carry amount, good carry amount we are focused on. So because enhancement has the performance of the assets will be changed. So I think we should be careful to introduce enhancement, because once the assets has been enhanced, whether it's original assets or it's new assets, we are focused on. So the second, and the third one is that we introduce notion of the potential. Actually, in practice, sometimes it's very difficult to judge what kind of probability of the potential. I know that under our revised concept, when we introduced the potential to produce economic benefit, we a notion. But in here, I think it's different. It's different. So we should be very cautious to introduce the potential. Otherwise, maybe open. Because we are doing impairment tests, trying to, you know, to resolve so-called too late, too small, you know, issues. Now we introduce notion of the potential notion. That's easier for the preparers. Okay, because with their potential to, although it seems there are some impairment indicator there, but there is a potential for the future restructuring or enhancement. then they are not necessary to do impairment test again. So I think there is a danger, and whether this change meets our objective of this project.
Nick.
Thank you. I guess I'm sympathetic because it seems to me that the bar around restructuring set at a very high level, that you actually have to start to incur some restructuring costs before you can start capturing the benefits. Having said that, I'm very sympathetic to the argument that Sue has, that here we may have what appears to be a simplification but may turn into more complexity, and in the sense that we're going to have some kind of embedded derivative here, that in terms of the optionality around restructuring, that we're going to suggest that companies will have to start valuing in terms of this revised approach, actually makes me want to stand back from it and say it's not really a simplification at all. So I wouldn't support the proposal. It's without more clarity around what it might mean in practice, and it actually was a simplification.
That's right.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to remind us of the discussion we had in December and the very close link I established at that time between going to the updated headroom approach and simplification, the calculation of value in use. And so lifting in fact those restrictions. So to me, the two decisions have to be closely related, otherwise not only we don't simplify, but we increase cost in all directions. And so that's the first point. The second point is that this paper has very valuably highlighted the fact that even though in our past discussions we were referring to value in use and fair value as using the same basis, the same cash flow forecast basis, in fact, in highlighting that the fair value in fact would be on an expected value basis and introduce these probabilities of management doing this or not doing that, shows that when you go to a value in use and you base that value in use on the latest cash flow forecast by management. I mean, I don't know of any management that do their cash flow forecast for management on an expected value. Then, I mean, these people have decision-making processes and they just forecast what they plan to do, exactly as we do when we run the foundation. So, and their prospects in building their budgets. I mean, I don't know of any managers that build budgets in order to fail those budgets. So, I mean, when you prepare your budget, you want to meet your targets. It's not a process in which you put a lot of ambition that you can't meet. Otherwise, you're a failing manager End of the year, you come to your supervisor and explain, I had this fantastic budget. I'm happy you didn't record an impairment loss, but now I'm a failure as a manager because we have not met the target. So I think that, in fact, the real simplification and the real, in fact, meaningful numbers that you can get is, of course, you need a solid and sound budgeting process solid. I mean, you would expect to rely on a robust budgeting process, but I think the closer we are going to be to using the budgets in determining the value in use, so that the updated headroom approach can apply, the better we will be. And that means that the value in use would be based on cash flow forecast at a point in time, I mean, estimates, and absolutely not fantasies of what may happen, not happen. Especially when the may happen, not happen is, in fact, the decisions that I, as a manager, will make. I have decided I was making. So you would not reflect things that you do not intend to do.
Martin?
And I support also this staff recommendation because I think these requirements to have only two look at restructuring the enhancements which are already committed to, I think is a little bit impractical, because man, in practice you're doing this kind of stuff, you're looking at your 5-year strategic forecast budget, and then to require, okay, to exclude from a manager, okay, his thinking about what is future restructuring, I think is artificial, really artificial, because manager doing the budget looking at kind what is a kind of achieved margin, cost income ratios, and clearly if after 2 years something happens, man, that is why management is there, they're doing something about that, which is maybe do restructurings and getting rid of people and do other things. So to have a requirement where say, okay, you should come up with a 5-year forecasted budget, but any management action which you are not committed to currently you should exclude is artificial. And therefore I think we should exclude this requirement and say, okay, you can do this future restructuring or enhancements. And the point, okay, is that we should maybe look at then managers or companies are not too optimistic, I think that is not new to that. Because man, even if you maybe have to forecast what is already committed to restructuring, you can do it optimistically. You can do all other cash flow very optimistically. I think that is not a specific point to this requirement. And if we are concerned about that managers or entities doing it too optimistic, we should doing something about the overall kind of forecasting budgets, but not specific to this point. That is what I think.
Gary?
Thank you. And I support the staff's recommendation, and but I'm reflecting on it. I think it's Sue said it. I mean, I don't think it should be so open-ended. If you go to the history of restructuring, go back to late 80s, early 90s, it was almost any thought that somebody had that was good enough to put a big restructuring charge on. Now under IAS 37, others, I think it's pretty restrictive to get it accrued. But there's a lot of steps between a wishful thought and hitting the requirements to accrual. You know, so in budgeting, I mean, there's budgets and there's budgets, and I think there should be some, at least some, at the periphery, some limits about what doesn't get it qualified. You would think if it's in the CODM's public forecast of earnings and cash flows, so that's pretty good, because that's a commitment, you know, not enough to accrue, but you put yourself on the line on it. You know, some middle manager, low manager that's in his budget request, you know, maybe not enough, you know, so you're really up at the CODM and equivalent type commitment. And so I think it's, so I'm with you. I think it should not be so open-ended that it's in my budget or my forecast. Forecast is different than budget. I mean, forecast is what I think is going to happen. A budget's my commitment and organizing a plan of action. I think, as you also point out in paragraph 21 about the artificial splits, in principle, every action of every company all the time should be trying to enhance assets and maximize the returns, and that manifests itself in many ways in just restructuring in it. So again, I think we're at the right place. I'd probably try to limit some stuff at the periphery, you know, that that's going to be better than where we were 25 years ago. Just I think about it, I can restructure it. So at least some rudimentary structure at the minimum.
Sue? I'm not sure if I spoke clearly or not. I don't disagree with the proposal to consider removing this restriction, because I completely agree that it seems to make sense to have an alignment between what the real plans are and what goes into this analysis. I just don't think we could be silent on what the criteria would be. So I'd like to know that if it was based on budget, that that's actually the expected outcome type budget, not like in banking, I think we sometimes had, you know, this is our worst case scenario, this is our sort of expected, this is our best case. Don't always choose the best case scenario. I think we just need to think about what sort of parameters we'd have around making it clear that these need to be sort of genuine, solid expectations, something like that. I'm not talking overkill, but if we look at all of our other requirements, in 37 we have criteria for at what point is it certain enough to do something, held for sale, what level of commitment do you need before we believe something is held for sale. All through our literature we think about parameters for when it's appropriate to include things, so I don't think it's inconsistent with our usual approach to think about, well, in this case, how robust does this need to be? And I agree it shouldn't need to be a formal commitment, because we're trying to move closer to, you know, the planning. than that, but it's, I don't think we should let it be a free-for-all on the other side, and that's my only point.
Tom?
Yes, echo, I think, what Jerry and Sue said. And note, I think paragraph 8 on cost is that preparers seem to see what we're doing now as cost being complex. So, and I think the big point, it's a discussion paper, and we can then validate this statement that this will reduce cost and complexity if we ask everybody to kind of come back. But the initial indication from preparers is that this would save them cost, right? So just echoing, and so I would support it, and I think a discussion paper is a great way to go.
I think we're talking about this because of the feedback from the preparers as part of a PIR. I don't totally buy the arguments of the staff when we go back and say, well, this is really how we can look at value in use, and I don't totally buy that. I think there were reasons why previously board members in their wisdom decided fair value was like this and value in use was like that. So there's not a strong theoretical case for this. I think it's a practical response. But I also think, looking at considering what we were doing in December, that this sits as part of what we were saying with the updated headroom approach. And this is a point that Françoise has made. So whilst I am in principle supportive of this, I also wonder what will happen if we get the updated headroom approach knocked out of any consultation document, which I got the impression last year that we all thought that would happen, that it will be knocked out. So then does this stay in, or are these two things, that is the updated headroom approach and this change, are they inextricably linked, is my question.
I don't think that this approach necessarily survives only with the updated headroom approach, but I think it always helps thinking about the two together. But I think on its own, it has some merits to be considered, whether or not we consider the updated headroom approach in the future. I think that's the reason I was linking back to the collective consideration that we had in December 2017. And I mean, if you remember the ticks, I think that's the reason we also sort of reminded that there is a moderate simplification. It also helps achieving the effectiveness objective together with the updated headroom approach. So that's how we sort of highlighted the collective consideration of the two together.
Doug.
Thank you. Just response to Françoise and Sue. I think the budget, how reliable the budget is all about, it depends on the management. Some management use budget to stretch the performance. So they always make a little more aggressive budget, and it's more like a target, which is not really achievable. And the question is, which one should we use for this impairment testing? The budget and forecast is different. And normally they have forecast if the closing is, you know, just around the corner, but they do not have real forecast for longer period. They only have stretched budget, and we are trying to achieve it. So the danger the Jin Chao mentioned may happen, because if nobody can disagree with the management budget, and it is the area that the auditor had a hard time, because auditor cannot really have a good information of counter argument. So I agree with this proposal. However, we need to consider to provide some clue that the auditor can counter argue against the management stretch budget.
I wanted to comment also on what and question to Raghava and Raghava. Answers to whether the two decisions, the updated headroom approach and the simplification, the value in use calculation, would be inextricably linked or not. Personally, I make the link, in fact, twofold. I make the link that I reminded us, which is we cannot go for what we would be perceived as being more complex, like the updated headroom approach, without having something that in fact makes it past the cost benefit constraint. But I also link the two together, because I think we have come to the conclusion that the current requirements are not satisfactory from an effectiveness perspective of the impairment test. So we have a deficit in the quality of the information. Mm-hmm. And if we reduce the cost, I think it would be good also that in the meanwhile, at the same time, we improve the quality. Mm-hmm. So I also link when I look at whether we make changes or not, I think those changes, I would want to improve the benefit side of things while we are achieving a reduction in cost. So to me, they go together from these two perspectives. And as far as constraints of safeguards, I'm certainly not going to oppose having those, because we want to have a reasonable reporting. But at the same time, we need to, when we build those, we need to make sure that they are they would not make a robust manager that establishes robust budgets change their data. That will be my criterion to assess the possible safeguards and criteria that we may put in.
We'll put that in the standard. The forecast should not be rubbish.
Martin? And again to this point, because I'm hearing that we should have some boundaries about that, and I'm really concerned about that, because why do we have these boundaries for this restructuring but not for all other cash flows which are in the budget? So if we are concerned about that we have too optimistic budgets or cash flows in this model, we should address it, but not only limited to this, because this is for me kind of, I think it is impractical and it adds a lot of cost and not a lot of benefits. And if we want to have this gone away, I think we should not come up with an additional kind of limitations. Because what Gary said, if we requiring that the ZODM has already approved that, usually entities do it in a different way. Some do a forecast of 5-year cash flows, which is maybe not then approved by the ZODM. It is only maybe done for 1 or 2 years. And so different kind of scenarios. And if we limit this kind of stuff, we achieving the opposite what we want to do, to make it easier and not so artificial. But as I said, if we all are concerned about too optimistic budgets or forecasts or cash flow forecasts, we should do something about all of the cash flows and not only limited to this limited number of cash flows.
I think in the December board papers, I think when we discussed the effectiveness measures and we first started analyzing as to what are the possible reasons for the too little too late issue, I think first we set out an analysis on the unwarranted management's optimism as part of that. But I think we sort of highlighted there that IAS 36 has some safeguards currently to stop managements from just building up visual thinking into the cash flow projections used for determining the recoverable amount. And I think there is something in IAS 36 which says that in projecting future cash flows, managements have to focus on external information, try use more external information in projecting the future cash flows, which I guess also meets your requirement that it has to be in general about cash flows and not about just the restructuring part. I'm not sure if that's helpful or something the board could think about.
Yeah. Mary?
I think this paper is good at demonstrating that the current restriction is probably too rigid and mechanical, and therefore it leads me to say I support the idea of the board consulting about changing this. But I'm really glad you went through all this analysis, because I think we probably had a risk of having moved ahead too superficially with just you know, proposing to take out a mechanical barrier without thinking through the implications. The concern I have is, you know, just I support the idea of consulting. I'm not sure I support going ahead with a preliminary view of taking it out, but I think we should consult about it. Now, I think from a conceptual perspective, you've made a very important point that what we should be trying to do is, you know, is measure the value, whether it's the fair value or the value in use of the asset in its current state. You know, that's the thing. You know, it's today's assets that we're trying to measure, not what the, you know, not a potential future item. And that has a lot of complexity, you know, that Sue raised at the beginning in terms of saying, how do you measure that? And today's rigid limit does two things. One is that, you know, you said in paragraph 13 it excludes the value of the potential from the measurement of value in use. And I think conceptually that doesn't make sense, and I think it makes it worse by relying on an accounting threshold, right, you know, in the current standard. So I think that's two strikes against it, but it might be just a very crude mechanism that was seen as overall the cost-benefit answer. I don't think we should try and justify it conceptually. But if we take away that, I do think we have to say, what is your measurement objective? And while I agree with the idea that budgets, even, you know, allowing for the existence of stretch budgets, et cetera, you know, should be management's expectation of what's going to happen, there's probably a better chance of management forecasting what they expect to spend and what steps they expect to take, but presumably they can't forecast with perfect accuracy what the external response is going to be, and that's the inflow of benefits, because presumably when you're looking at any kind of restructuring, you're only going to do it if you think the net benefit is positive. Very often restructurings are net costs in the short term for benefit, you know, but the answer is always because we think it's going to be benefits in the long term. Because we're doing value in use, we're asking people to look at over that whole period and say, what are the net expected benefits? So people are always, it's always going to be a net increment if you include the effect of future restructurings. Because otherwise you wouldn't be doing it, and you're looking at it over the whole life. So I think we should consult about this. People, users have identified it as adding cost and complexity and reducing the usefulness of the information. If we go about it on a, you know, conceptual basis, we take out this limit, we'd say you're supposed to be measuring the asset in its present, you know, present condition, including potential. But I think that brings in a lot of the complexities that Sue raised in her initial comments about if you were really trying to do this, it's X. If we just, you know, if we say, you know, that's so complex, you might not want to go there, do you just take out the limit and, let's say, do whatever management budgets? You know, I think we have to consult about that. So support consulting, don't support going out saying, therefore, let's just take it away. I think we have to draw out what the pros and cons are, and I think we should not try and conceptually rationalize what we have today. It may be the least worst bad thing, and that's why it's there.
The least worst bad what?
The least worst thing that, you know, that it's there, not because it's a conceptual conclusion, because when they weighed up the risks and benefits of how you approach this thing, it was the handiest, least bad outcome rather than a, you know, positively good requirement.
All right. Okay, Nick?
Yeah, sorry, just three follow-up points. First of all, I don't think we formally decided whether this would be DP or ED as our next due process document, and I worry that sometimes we talk about it, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that we go one way or another, so I know that's on the agenda for next month. Secondly, just to be clear, I'm not the biggest fan of updated headroom, but I am in favour of simplification. I just want to make sure this is a simplification. And my understanding is at the moment, companies do their budgets, they take out a restructuring to calculate value and use, and potentially we'd allow them to use that restructuring element going forward, but then to add another stage to probability weight those is a concern. I just want to make sure we're not going there. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think just picking up on Mary's point, I think this is much more driven by preparers. Users aren't in the weeds of this. I don't think this is really an issue that comes up for users. per se. This is really about helping this work for preparers, I'm saying.
That might be affecting timeliness, which they could.
Indeed, indirectly, yes.
Amaro.
Thanks, well, generally, I think the proposal to explore is very valid one. I think the exclusion as it is today is somewhat disaligned with our comfort in IFRS 13, for instance. When we talk about expected cash flows in general, we are comfortable enough to say level three, you just include everything you expect, so you don't have much of requirements to exclude, right? So it's to me two ways of approaching the same basics to calculate something that you expect in the future associated with cash flow. So my initial reaction was yes, of course, let's try to make it more aligned with what we have in other standards. That said, I think the words of warning to say that it's not a free for all. It's wise. I think we should explore considering what we can do to somewhat frame a little bit better. We have some experience in IFRS 9 when we talk about business model. So we in other standards we were able to establish some limits, let's say, or requirements or indicators that could put some limitations in the process. So I think we are in the right direction. My initial reaction is that this seems to be a simplification to the process, because if I do have this budgeted in the sense that I have to exclude everything that I truly expect, it apparent to me that is more complex than it should be. So in that said, I think we are in the right direction in here.
Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Just add two points. One is that practical cases, as we all know that one of the UK biggest construction company, Carillion, collapsed. And I checked its financial statement. The goodwill, the amount of the goodwill accounts for about 70% of total assets. Mm-hmm. And then no impairment loss recognized. And I know that before the company collapsed, some structuring plan could happen. But whether this kind of thing could be, you know, as an excuse or as a reason, those companies cannot be recognized any impairment losses for those goodwills. There is a really danger. If we change the policy, and if we change the policy, we need firm discipline of this new policy. And secondly, the reason we introduce the notion of the potential for restructuring or enhancement, I think there are two notions. One is paragraph 11, second is paragraph 12. The staff think that the current condition of the assets contains a potential to restructure or enhance the assets. The second is that the paragraph 12 said that the fair value of such an asset would include the value attributable to that potential. I look at the IFRS 13 and also we did PIR of IFRS 13. Actually, IFRS 13 required highest and the best use of a non-financial asset to be considered when measuring its fair value. And the feedback we got that many, I think at least some response said that in practice, in their experience, the current use of an asset is also its highest and best use. So I'm wondering when we are doing the outreach or we are doing whether we get any feedback, so-called current use, including those potential to restructure or enhance those assets. I think it's very important because it's all not only relevant to the value in use, but also relevant to the fair value. Whether those fair value measurements include those potential to restructure or enhancement of the assets with regard to the highest and the best use. Highest best use whether include the potential to the restructure or enhancement of the assets.
You want to complicate that a little bit.
Yes, but I think well, this is the point we come from. We borrow from the idea what's the current use mean, current condition or current use mean, and what's the fair value we refer to.
Changu.
Thank you. The comments I would like to make some response. If you see the paragraph 21, the paper is the last paragraph. This last paragraph suggests that this all change is useful to users. So if you see the last sentence of this paragraph, the complexities are removed because we don't need to separate maintenance capital structure and expansionary capital structure anymore. So that's a kind of a complexity is removed. So in the case, you know, maybe to users.
It's only for preparers. Users won't see any of that.
Don't see anything.
It's only for preparers.
No. But generally, they are in the existing practice might be, you know, some maintenance capital structure is accepted as a kind of a cash flows, but some expansionary capital structure might be a kind of a issue whether that should be included the value use or not. So the separation of these two cash flows might be some arbitrary to users. So maybe that kind of information might hurt the investor to make some kind of decision. But if we do this kind of an improvement, we don't need such a kind of arbitrary separation. That means that use information maybe more useful to users.
I don't think this information is exposed to users, whether it's maintenance or not. The users don't get to see the calculations behind this how we calculate value and use. So and users also realise that division is arbitrary as well, and haven't really pushed for that information for the very reasons you say.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I think the point the paper was trying to make was that the outcome is based on numbers that try to make that distinction. And so I think the team's conclusion was that the information is likely to be more useful to users if the outcome isn't based on an arbitrary distinction.
I think it's likely to be more useful all round.
Okay, can we see if we agree with the staff's recommendation?
What's the consequence of voting on this?
Is this for annual?
That would mean it would go into the due process document with some discussion of, discuss further what that would be, or there'll be another discussion that would follow this one then at the board table?
I think the idea is, as I said, we assume that the next stage would be a discussion paper, so I think it's more like consulting on, I know it's good to remove. I think it all goes back to what we said in paragraph 14, that I think it's difficult in practice to distinguish between an existing potential already within the asset and a future, a different asset in the future.
I think Sue's raising the same point that Mary did earlier, which is, are we saying here preliminary view or not? And I think consider is also the word we use for the decisions in
December.
In December. Clearly what we need to do at least is bring back the summary of decisions all together to you anyway. Whether that's expressed as a preliminary view or in some other way is something we might need to think about what's the best way to phrase that. But I think what we have in mind is presenting this package and a discussion of the items within this package as a package that the board is exploring. The exact words we put against that I think we'll might think about a bit more.
I was going to say, I think in terms of the vote that you're asking us to take today is, as long as it's not, it automatically converts to, if we decide to go ED route, it doesn't automatically convert to a, we are proposing to remove it, here's the thing. Because I think once we make a decision.
Those are all the decisions that they're, you know, dependent on the nature of the due process document.
That's right. And clearly, if we went down the ED route, we'd need to flesh some of these things out in quite a bit more detail anyway. So.
What's that?
Yeah, I was ready to go for a vote, but I would like to be explicit that this would not be on expected value basis.
We haven't discussed that.
Well, I mean, that's been part of our discussion, and I didn't necessarily hold that view. I don't, and it's not fleshed out in the paper, because this is sort of why I'm asking the question, because it's a very simple question we're being asked. Does the board wish to consider removing from 36 this? And we're willing to consider many things. Depends what's in its place.
I mean, certainly in a DP, I think we'd need to discuss that aspect anyway, because there'd obviously be pros and cons. Whether you want to settle on one view, and I think Sue's probably right that it probably wouldn't be a good idea to press you for a conclusion on that at this stage. We can maybe come back to that.
We could ask the people for feedback on what they would think, you know, what if any criteria we could have around it. I'm not pushing for expected value. I just don't think we've had that detailed discussion or a paper that's sort of asking us to think about the issues.
Okay, again, who supports the staff's recommendation?
As worded.
Yeah. I put my foot in the door.
It's going in the right direction, thanks, Bob.